That's okay. I think I'm just going to read this afternoon. You can have the computer. I thought you were going to start writing again, Maureen said. Maybe tomorrow, he said. Maybe I'll start tomorrow. He awoke to the sound of Maureen's fax machine. Barry squinted over at the clock and was surprised to see that it was almost 8. The light outside, seeping between the cracks of the mini-blinds, looked too dark for 8, looked more like 6, and he nudged Maureen next to him. Get up, it's 8 o'clock. What? She opened one sleepy eye. It's late. They'd both overslept, and it was the sound of the fax machine more than his prodding that made Maureen get out of bed and face the day. He turned onto his side and watched her bare buttocks as she padded naked over to the bathroom. Even after all these years, she still looked damn good. And if she didn't have so much work to do this morning and the fax wasn't prompting her to get started on it, he would have lured her back to bed and spent the next hour engaged in some dirty, nasty sex that was more than likely illegal here in the state of Utah. But instead, he got up, slipped into his jeans, and went upstairs to put on the coffee. He took out the Friskies box and pulled open the shades on the sliding glass door, intending to feed Barney breakfast on the top deck, but the cat was nowhere to be seen. Barry walked back downstairs to the bedroom, where Maureen was already dressed and making the bed, but when he pulled the drapes open, there was again no sign of the cat. Huh, he said. What? I can't find Barney. I told you we should make that cat sleep inside. There are coyotes, skunks, and who knows what out there. You'd better make sure he's okay. Barry slid open the door, slid open the screen, and walked outside, shaking the Friskies box. Barney, he called. Nothing. Barney? He shook the box again. There were no noises in the bushes or in the tree that the cat used as a ladder between the upper and lower decks, and frowning, Barry walked down the wooden steps off the deck and around to the front of the house, where he stopped. The flowers they'd planted had been ripped out and thrown into the driveway between the Suburban and the Toyota. Uprooted rose bushes lay littered on the asphalt. Geraniums and impatiens, clods of dirt still sticking to their roots, draped the Suburban's white hood. Iris bulbs were strewn about like golf balls on a driving range. Someone had sneaked onto their property in the middle of the night and destroyed their fledgling garden, had negated all of their hard work, and his first reaction was one of anger. He wanted to beat the shit out of whoever had done this. But there was unease mixed in there as well, and while it was probably just kids, pretty sick kids, he couldn't help feeling slightly disturbed by the fact that their house was the target of this vandalism, that they had been specifically chosen to be the recipients of this attack. His gaze shifted to the various areas they'd landscaped, and he saw that every last plant they'd put in had been pulled out of the ground or trampled. Their property looked as though a mini hurricane had hit it, and only pine trees and manzanitas seemed to remain standing. And there was still no sign of Barney. His gaze alighted on the mailbox. With a sinking feeling in his gut, he walked around the Suburban. He stepped up to the mailbox and paused, then reached out and pulled open the rounded metal door. There was nothing inside. He let out a sigh of relief, unaware until that second that he'd been holding his breath. He'd been almost certain that he'd find the cat mutilated, its body stuffed into the mailbox, and he had never been so thankful to be wrong. He turned back toward the house, intending to bring Maureen out here and show her the damage, when he saw a glimpse of fuzzy black amidst the light green stems and deep magenta flowers that had been tossed onto the driveway between the cars. He knew without looking closer exactly what that fuzzy black was, but he moved forward nevertheless, bending down to examine the object more fully. Barney. The cat was lying atop two discarded plants, and its dead open eyes were staring upward at the bumper of the Toyota. White foam was dripping from the animal's mouth onto the asphalt, where it had already puddled into an irregular pool. He wasn't an expert on these things, but he was pretty sure that Barney had been poisoned, and he hurried into the house, dragging Maureen away from her fax to show her the damage outside. My God, she breathed. She looked around the property at the upturned vegetation and the dead cat, Who do you think did this? Barry shook his head, completely at a loss. They didn't know anyone here other than Ray and Liz and the other people they'd met at the Dyson's party, and his gut reaction was that it was probably an act of random vandalism perpetrated by bored teenagers looking for a thrill. But whether they were teenagers from town or the kids of parents who lived in Bonita Vista, he had no idea. Pretty sick kids. "Do you think we should call the police?" he asked. "Hell yes," Maureen said angrily. "I want the assholes who did this prosecuted. We spent almost $100 on those new plants, not to mention all the work we put into clearing brush. And they can't get away with killing Barney. I mean, what kind of creep would poison a defenseless little animal like that?" He had no idea, but it made him furious as well. They hadn't had Barney long enough to feel real sadness at his loss, but they felt rage at what had been done, and he, too, wanted justice, his indignation fueled and amplified by Maureen's righteous anger, pushing aside his earlier uneasiness. There was no police station in Corbin, but he called the sheriff's office to report the vandalism, and 20 minutes later, a tan Dodge with the sheriff's insignia painted on the doors pulled into the driveway. The deputy who emerged from the vehicle was not the stereotypical redneck he'd been expecting, but a skinny, unassertive kid who looked as though he were still in high school. Barry and Maureen met him in the driveway. "I'm Wally Addison," the deputy said, nodding. He was trying to look authoritative, but didn't have either the face or the years to pull it off. He withdrew a metal clipboard from the front seat of the car. "I understand you've had some vandalism on your property. You need this reported for your insurance?" "No," Maureen said. "We want whoever did this caught." "Caught?" Barry frowned. "Of course." "I'll be honest with you," the deputy said. "There's a lot of vandalism around these parts. People shooting up stop signs, tipping over cows, batting mailboxes, what have you. And unless there's an eyewitness, we hardly ever catch the people who do it." Maureen looked at him levelly. "What does that mean? You're not even going to try?" "No, no," he said nervously, trying to assure her. "We'll do our best to apprehend the culprit. I just wanted you to know that the odds of doing so are not in our favor." "Well, we don't care about your past track record," Maureen said. "We expect you to find out who killed our cat and tore up our yard, and we expect you to arrest him." "Of course, ma'am, of course. Now, if I can just get some information from you good people, we can get started." Barry described how he'd looked for the cat, going through his discovery step by step. Maureen stated that the last time she'd seen Barney had been after dinner, when she'd fed him some leftover chicken on the top deck. Neither of them had had any run-ins with neighbors or had seen any mysterious individuals lurking about. Neither was aware of any grudges held against them or any reason why they would be targeted. The deputy dutifully took everything down, and with an uncertain glance at Maureen stated that it sounded to him as though this was a random attack, probably carried out by troublemaking teenage boys. But, he added hurriedly, the sheriff's department would do everything in its power to solve this case. He gave Barry a carbon of his report and a business card with his beeper number, promising to call as soon as there was any information to report. Ray showed up before the deputy left, and he remained silent, staying unobtrusively in the background until the tan car pulled out of the driveway and headed back down the road. Maureen headed back inside the house, and Barry walked over to where Ray stood waiting.
"I saw the hubbub from my window," Ray said. "What's going on?"
Barry gestured around. "Take a look for yourself. Someone poisoned our cat and tore up Moe's plants."
"And you called the sheriff?"
"Of course. What did you expect me to do?"
"What I mean is, are you sure this was illegal? Did the sheriff or whoever that guy was give any indication that this wasn't a crime?"
"What are you talking about?"
"The sheriff's office has been known to assist the homeowners association in disputes with individuals."
"You think someone from the homeowners association killed our cat?" Barry asked incredulously. Ray shrugged.
"I'm not saying anything. I'm just pointing out that under the bylaws, pets are prohibited in any residence within Bonita Vista."
He was quiet for a moment, tilting his head.
"Hear that? No dogs barking. I don't know if you've noticed, but there are no domestic animals of any kind within Bonita Vista. No dogs or cats, no hamsters, no goldfish."
He met Barry's eyes.
No pets.
But it's in the CC&Rs. Barry thought of the dead cat in the mailbox and found that he could not dismiss the idea entirely.
What about the plants, though? This is vandalism. This isn't enforcement of regulations.
You're supposed to get approval from the architectural committee before any landscaping changes are made, Ray said quietly.
He didn't believe it, not really. But the idea sent a quiet chill down his spine. Was it possible that someone from the homeowners association had come to their house in the middle of the night and, while they were sleeping, poisoned their cat and dug up their garden? He recalled Neil Campbell, the man with the clipboard, and it didn't seem all that far-fetched.
But people wouldn't put up with this, would they? I mean,
he shook his head. Even in some place like Utah, especially in some place like Utah, it seems like people would be more individualistic. Like they wouldn't want to get involved in things like homeowners associations.
Ray snorted.
For people who are so anti-government and anti-regulation, they're pretty well sold on this association crap. I mean, hell, most of them are NRA members who pitch a shit fit every time there's so much as a whisper of trigger lock legislation. But they have no problem with making a homeowner come before one of their damn committees if he wants to trim a tree or plant a flower on his own property.
NRA members, huh?
Ray waved his hand. Don't let that scare you. I kicked one of them off my lot just last month. They're tough when they're sending out memos or holding a meeting, but one-on-one they're pussy boys. Pardon my French.
What happened? Why were they harassing you?
I put up a storage shed. It isn't even visible from the street, but apparently someone saw me unloading the materials from my truck and turned me in. It's like the goddamn Third Reich around here. Everyone's an informant.
Ray! Barry!
Barry looked toward the street, where Frank Hodges, one of the men he'd met the other night at Ray's house, was walking toward them, waving.
I saw the sheriff's car. What happened?
Barry went through it again, told how he'd been looking for the cat to feed at breakfast, and had discovered the animal's dead body along with the uprooted plants.
Frank shook his head sympathetically.
Ray says there's a prohibition against pets.
Frank nodded.
Yeah, the association doesn't want...
He stopped, frowned.
Wait a minute, are you...
Barry gestured around at the damage.
We were wondering if this could be... policy.
No, he shook his head. They might be jerks and uptight assholes, but they wouldn't do this. Destruction of property is the last thing they would authorize. The problem with the association is that they're too strict about upkeep of property, about making sure everyone conforms to their standards. There's no way they would deliberately vandalize a lot in Bonita Vista. They might clean it up for you and send you the bill, but they wouldn't damage it.
He had expected support from Ray, corroboration, but the old man was silent, and the expression on his face was one that Barry found unreadable.
Everyone's an informant.
Now he was just being paranoid.
He looked over at Frank.
Wasn't he?
He'd been planning to confide in the other man, share his thoughts openly, attempt to forge an ally, but instead he nodded absently and said, "Yeah, you're probably right." He did not look at Ray again. He told the others that they were welcome to hang around and watch, or help if they so desired, but he needed to get to work. There was a lot of cleaning up to do.
"Take pictures first," Frank suggested. "This is all probably covered under your homeowner's insurance."
"Good idea," Barry said. "Thanks."
Ray and Frank walked away, waving, and he watched them for a moment before heading around the side of the house to find a shovel and bury Barney.
7. The Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions, Article 3, Land Use Classifications, Permitted Uses and Restrictions, Section 3, Paragraph C. No animal, fish, or fowl shall be kept, permitted, or maintained on any lot. No owner shall remove, alter, or interfere in any way with any shrubs, trees, grass, or plants without the written consent of the association having first been obtained. No improvements, alterations, or other work which in any way alters the exterior appearance of any property shall be made or done without the prior approval of the Architectural Committee.
8. The adjustment was easier than she'd expected. Maureen had worried that she'd go stir-crazy working at home rather than in an office, dealing with her clients over the phone, through email, and by fax, but in truth it was liberating. Her life had been pared down to its essentials, and she loved it. Now she could take time off in the middle of the day to watch a movie or read a book. If work became too frustrating or overwhelming, she didn't have to take a sick day. She could just opt out for a few hours, go outside, and dig in her garden. True, it was a little hard to get used to the lack of human contact and interaction, but Barry was always around, and any time she wanted, she could walk up to the Dysons and visit with Liz. It was a good life, and despite the vandalism of their property, her initial reservations about Bonita Vista faded away with the passing of days. As expected, the sheriff had failed to find whoever had killed Barney and dug up their yard, but luckily it had not happened again. They'd bought new flowers and shrubs, replanted, and for the past 2 weeks everything had been fine. Barry still seemed half convinced that it was part of some sinister plot on the part of the Homeowners Association, but she had never put much stock in that theory, and as the days and weeks passed, it began to seem more and more ludicrous. She'd taken to walking each morning, going on a brisk 20 to 40 minute stroll through the neighborhood, getting to know the area, acclimatizing herself to the altitude, and engaging in some much-needed exercise. The more she explored, the more she liked Bonita Vista, and the more sure she was that they had made the right decision by moving here. The houses, spaced far apart on large lots, were uniformly well-kept, yet distinctively individual, and the view in every direction was spectacular. Although she enjoyed the scenery to the south, that breathtaking panorama in which forests segued to desert canyon land and the horizon was so far away that you could see the curve of the earth, in truth she preferred the view to the north, and it was when she was walking up the hill, facing the heavily wooded plateau directly behind Bonita Vista, that she felt most at home, that she felt a part of this place. Maureen strode purposefully down the sloping street that went around the back of their hill. Most of the houses here were vacant vacation homes, but even the residences that were obviously occupied year-round seemed empty, their owners either gone to work or off on errands. From somewhere in the muffled distance came the faint sound of pounding hammers, the noise of construction, and here and there in the brush random bird cries rang out in the still morning air. Other than that, the world was quiet. There were no dog barks or cat yowls. Barry was right about that. Domestic animals were not allowed in Bonita Vista, and she thought of poor Barney, buried on the east side of the house. It had been nice to have a cat, even for a few weeks, and while she didn't believe that the Homeowners Association had anything to do with the animal's death, she still resented the organization for disallowing pets. The houses grew farther apart as the road rounded the back side of the hill and dipped into a narrow area between the hill and the plateau. Many of the lots here remained unsold, and rusted real estate signs were posted next to the white lot number stakes. She passed a small empty A-frame with a chain blocking the driveway, and a rustic log cabin with a 3-car garage. The road turned again, heading into a copse of tall ponderosas. There were no homes on this section of road, only the uncleared forest pressing in, and though it was mid-morning, the positioning of the hill and trees kept most of the route in shadow. Ahead, she thought she saw something, a still figure that was not a bush, not a tree, not a road sign, a man. He stood by the side of the road, unmoving, and Maureen was grateful that he was not close enough to hear her surprised intake of air. She halted for a moment and bent down, hands on her knees, pretending she'd been running and was only taking a small break from regimented exercise. She counted to 10, then broke into a jog, keeping to the side of the road opposite the unmoving figure, ready to bolt should he make any movement toward her. It was probably nothing, she told herself. Years of L.A. living had simply made her paranoid, fearful of strangers. He was probably just a fellow resident of Bonita Vista, one of her neighbors out for a stroll. There was no reason for her to assume that he was in any way a threat. But he was just standing there, not moving. Better safe than sorry. Following through on her serious exercise ruse, ready to ignore him completely or smile in a friendly manner, depending on his reaction to her, she jogged by. Fuck you, the man said. His voice was deep and raspy, sickly sounding, and there was something menacing in not only the words but the tone in which they were spoken. She was afraid to look at the man's face, afraid of what she might see there, and she sprinted faster, her heart pumping with fear as well as exertion. There were houses ahead, and whether or not they were occupied, she was grateful to be once again in the vicinity of human habitation. The road headed up the side of the hill, and though her muscles were starting to ache, and her mouth was painfully dry from breathing so hard and heavily, she ratcheted up the intensity a few notches and managed to maintain her speed as she ran toward the crest of the incline. She stopped at the top to catch her breath and casually turned around to look behind her. The man was striding purposefully up the road toward the spot where she stood. Panic flared within, and all Maureen could think was that she was being chased, that this man was after her. He seemed even more frightening in the full sunlight. She had not gotten a good look at him before, but she saw now that he was tall and hairy, with a wild mane and bushy beard. The weather was warm, but he wore a flannel overcoat, and even from this distance his heavy boots made a staccato slapping sound on the pavement, the noise absurdly loud in the stillness.
"Fuck you!"
the man yelled, his voice echoing. And he started to run. Crying out, Maureen sped forward as fast as her feet would carry her, ignoring the protestations of her leg muscles and lungs, wanting only to get away from this psycho and his irrationally dogged pursuit. She raced the rest of the way up the hill to Liz and Ray's house and fairly flew over the gravel of their driveway, pounding furiously on the door, praying to God that they were home. She glanced back over her shoulder to make sure the man was not coming onto their property after her, already planning how she would make her escape if he was. Liz opened the door almost immediately, and Maureen pushed breathlessly past her into the house, shutting the door and fumbling frantically for the lock. Some of her panic seemed to have transferred to Liz.
What is it? What's wrong?
Maureen held a hand up, shaking her head, trying to catch her breath, then moved over to the window, looking out. The man was there, on the road, standing at the edge of the driveway, and she pointed.
That guy, she managed to get out. He's following me.
Who is he?
I don't know.
Liz frowned, peeking out.
Ray's at the store. Check that door and make sure it's locked. I'm calling the sheriff.
Wait, Maureen said. Look!
Outside, on the road, a car had pulled up next to the man, and two other men were getting out, one approaching her pursuer from the left side, the other from the right. Liz moved away from the window.
That's Chuck Shea and Terry Abbey.
She quickly unlocked and opened the door.
Chuck, Terry!
They looked over, saw Liz, and waved.
Hey there, the taller man called out.
That guy's been chasing my friend Maureen here. I was just about to call the sheriff.
Call, the tall man said. We'll hold him.
He turned to his friend. Told you this joker was up to no good. Liz retreated to the kitchen, where Maureen heard her dialing the phone and giving the person on the opposite end of the line a quick rundown. Outside, Chuck and Terry were making sure the bearded man wasn't going to go anywhere. Their car was behind him, and they stood on both sides, effectively blocking off all escape routes.
Fuck you!
The man yelled. He looked toward the house, toward Maureen.
Fuck you!
They're on their way, Liz said, returning.
They didn't have long to wait. 5 minutes later, they heard a siren in the distance, and 2 minutes after that, a sheriff's car was pulling to a stop in front of the Dysons' driveway. She and Liz had remained inside just in case, but with the arrival of the law, they walked out. This time, the sheriff himself showed up. An older fellow with the hard, sinewy look of a reptile and the improbable name of Hitman, he brought with him another deputy, this one young but seriously overweight, and the two of them forced the bearded man into the back of the car. They didn't even try to talk to him, apparently intending to ask questions later. Maureen was the one who had been chased, and she described her encounter, telling the sheriff how she'd run past the man, how he'd yelled out an obscenity, and how he'd followed her up the road.
I don't know if he was chasing me. I mean, I don't know if that would technically be considered chasing, but I felt,
don't worry about it, the sheriff told her. He nodded to the deputy, who'd been writing everything down. Johnson, you get all that?
Yes, sir.
The deputy looked around at the gathered group.
I just need your names, addresses, and daytime phone numbers.
He took down the necessary information, and Terry, after giving his stats, took the sheriff off to the side for a moment and peeled off a business card, handing it to him. The two of them conferred quietly. A few moments later, with the man in the back seat yelling, "Fuck you! Fuck you!" the sheriff and his deputy got in the car and drove back down the road toward town. Maureen watched the car head down the hill. She shook her head. "Sheriff Hitman?" she said incredulously. They all laughed. Chuck moved next to her. "Are you all right?" he asked. "You want a ride home or something?" She shook her head. "No, but thanks for asking." "All in a day's work," he said with an exaggerated southwestern drawl. "Ma'am?" Liz smiled. "Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, Terry. You're good guys, no matter what anyone says." "Yes, thank you," Maureen said gratefully. "No problem. That's what homeowners associations are for." "I..." She reddened, caught off guard. "What?" "You don't have to say it." He laughed and looked over at Liz. "I know our reputation around these parts."
"Don't blame me."
Terry chuckled. "Comes with the territory." "A lot of people bristle at the restrictions," Chuck admitted. "But in an unincorporated area like this, an association is the only means we have of taking care of basic needs. You want to be hard-nosed and cynical about it? It helps maintain order. And things like the gate keep out most of the riffraff. But the other side of the coin is that it also fosters a sense of community. You've seen the courts, right? The tennis courts?" Maureen nodded. "We haven't used them yet, but yeah, I've seen them." "There you go. We're also going to be building a community pool, maybe a clubhouse. We have our own little world here, a world that's better than the one surrounding it. And if that means that our standards need to be a little higher, that our rules need to be a little more strict, that we need to put out a little extra effort, well, that's a price that most of our residents are more than happy to pay." He smiled at Liz. "Most of our residents." "Some of the townies," Terry gestured down the street, where the sheriff's car had disappeared, "resent us for that. Chuck and I are on the security committee, which means that it's our responsibility to keep an eye out for unfamiliar faces or suspicious behavior. We don't get too many outside disruptions here, but when we do, it's usually some local yokel who's ticked off at us about something. We have better houses, or better cars, or better jobs, or better retirement plans. I don't know what this particular guy's story is, but 9 times out of 10 it's something like that."
"This has happened before?" Maureen asked.
"Oh, no," Chuck said quickly. "Nothing like this. But there have been breaches in security, let's say. And like Terry explained, it's usually some teed-off townie."
"Teed-off or drunk?"
"Teed-off or drunk," Chuck amended.
"You know," Maureen said, "someone vandalized our house a couple weeks ago. Well, not our house, really, our yard. And they killed our cat, although it wasn't really our cat. It was just a stray and we were feeding it. We'd sort of adopted it."
Terry frowned. "Did you file a complaint with the association? I don't remember hearing about this."
"Oh, no, we just called the sheriff."
"You should have filed a complaint. In fact, not to be too much of a stickler, you're required to file one according to the CC&Rs. He held up a hand. "I'm not blaming you. You're new and you didn't know. But we like to keep up with what's happening here, particularly if it's something like vandalism, something that could happen to any of us. It helps us know what to keep an eye out for."
Chuck nodded.
"I wouldn't even be surprised if this guy was involved. He seems to have been targeting you, and maybe he picked you out as a symbol or something. You're young, good-looking, and probably to him you're rich. In his eyes, you're probably the perfect candidate for harassment."
"Don't worry," Terry said. "The sheriff's going to phone me once he has a chance to interview this loser. I'll call and let you know as soon as I hear anything."
He opened the passenger door of the car, and Chuck walked around to the driver's side.
"You sure you don't need a ride home?"
Maureen shook her head.
"Thanks, but I'm going to stay and talk to Liz for a while."
The two men got into the car, waving as they drove down the hill, and Maureen turned to Liz.
"They don't seem that bad," she said.
"No," her friend admitted. "Sometimes they're not."
Barry was on the couch when she returned, reading over the pages he'd written that morning,
and though the immediacy of what happened to her had faded during the half-hour visit with Liz, seeing him comfortably ensconced in the living room, knowing that he'd been sitting here alone and happily self-absorbed while she'd been running up the road in fear for her life, irritated her somehow. He looked up. "Hey, what took you so long?"
"I was chased down the street by a psycho, and the sheriff, had to arrest him and take him away."
Barry stood quickly, dropping his papers, and rushed over to her.
"What?"
She explained it all, from the beginning, going into more detail than she had with Hitman, emphasizing the way she felt, the menacing feeling she'd gotten from her hairy pursuer. Barry kept interrupting with exclamations of, "Jesus!" and his genuine expressions of worry and concern softened the resentment she'd felt. They ended up hugging, and she found herself reassuring him that it wasn't really that bad, that she was never in any real danger, that it sounded a lot worse than it was. His first impulse was to drive down to the sheriff's office and confront this guy, make sure that charges were pressed, but she convinced him to wait, to let law enforcement authorities do their jobs. They walked upstairs together to the kitchen. He poured himself some orange juice, while she had the last of the coffee. "Kind of ironic that it was two homeowners association guys who helped you out." She shrugged.
"Maybe we've been a little too hard on them."
Barry looked at her incredulously.
"Too hard? They tore up our yard and killed our cat." "I don't think they did."
"Really? What proof did you suddenly discover that...
What proof do you have that it was them?"
She shook her head.
"Jesus, Barry, for someone who prides himself on being fair and open-minded and willing to think outside the lines, you sure can be a rigid linear son of a bitch."
"I'm sorry, I don't mean to dismiss what happened, even though that's exactly what you're doing. But don't go giving credit where credit isn't due. These two guys are part of the association. Fine. They helped you out. Fine. But that's it. They didn't do anything anyone else wouldn't do. Liz is the one who let you in her house. She's the one who called the sheriff. Would you have stopped to help someone you didn't even know?"
"The way you described it, I got the impression that they didn't stop to help you, that you were in Ray's house and they just stopped to check on this guy because he looked suspicious."
"That's true. It was like a neighborhood watch, which is even better. They weren't just looking out for me. They were concerned about what this character might do to anyone in the neighborhood. Would you do that?"
Barry smiled.
"No, but I'm an egotistical, self-obsessed writer focused only on my own career."
"You're only half joking."
"Half? I'm not joking at all." The phone rang, and Barry quickly moved to pick it up.
"I'll get it," he said.
They'd left the cordless on the dining room table, and he grabbed the handset and pressed the talk button.
"Hello?"
He handed her the phone.
"It's for you."
It was Chuck Shea. He'd heard back from the sheriff, and the man who'd been harassing her had confessed to the killing of their cat and the destruction of their plants. He had apparently vandalized several other homes within Bonita Vista, vacation homes whose owners had not yet been by to discover the damage, and the sheriff was in the process of compiling a list of acts and addresses. The man, Deke Meldrum, had some sort of grudge against the neighborhood, although the reasons for that remained vague.
"Probably a disgruntled handyman or something," Chuck opined. "Last year, the association contracted with a local maintenance company to provide all groundskeeping services for the greenbelts and communal property, and it ticked off some of the freelancers when we did that. I think this guy was one of them. There's something vaguely familiar under all that hair."
"So what's going to happen? Has he been arrested?"
"Oh, yeah."
"He's not just going to turn around and get out."
"Don't worry," Chuck assured her. "The association will press charges and make sure that he is prosecuted. He'll be in jail for quite a while."
"Is there anything I need to do?"
"We'll take care of everything. You probably won't even have to testify. With so many Bonita Vista properties involved, the association will be the complainant, and the most we'll need from you will be a statement. Terry and I are going down to the sheriff's office right now, and we'll let you know if anything else comes up."
"Keep us informed."
"Don't worry, we will."
Maureen thanked him for the information, said goodbye, and put the phone back down on the table, breathing an audible sigh of relief.
"Thank God."
"What?" That was Chuck. He said the sheriff called, and the guy who chased me is the guy who killed Barney and trashed our plants. His name's Deke Meldrum, and he's some kind of gardener or handyman. Apparently, he vandalized several other houses, too, vacation houses, and they're going to get him for all of them.
Do we have to go down and swear out a complaint or something?
No, the Homeowners Association is pressing charges.
Barry was silent.
Come on, you can't have a problem with that. What, you think there's some sort of vast conspiracy, and now that you and Ray are on to them, they're trying to pin everything on a psycho gardener? That doesn't sound ridiculous even to you?
He said nothing, but she saw the look of embarrassment on his face and pressed forward.
The association is not the bad guy here. They're the ones going after the bad guy. Whatever else they do, however much they cramp your style, they're on our side in this case.
I just don't like them.
You can't admit that maybe you've been a little harsh and unyielding, that there's a slight possibility you might be wrong.
He looked at her, took a deep breath.
All right, he said. I might be wrong.
She nodded.
Okay. I might be. You are, she told him.
And she found that she believed it.
9.
The Gordon Lightfoot album ended, and Barry continued typing. He didn't like to write without music, but he was on a roll, and for once the silence didn't seem to affect his concentration. 10 minutes later, however, he hit a creative brick wall, and though he tried to keep going, leaving increasingly longer spaces between words with the intention of filling them in later, it was obvious that he was stuck, and he finally gave up, wheeled his chair back from the desk, and walked over to the stereo. He sorted through his pile of vinyl and put on an old Joni Mitchell record, staring out at the view. There was something about those folkies of the late 60s, early 70s that complemented nature, that understood the rural lifestyle. There was a wistfulness in the music as well, a tinge of melancholy that somehow bridged the hopes of that era with the reality of today and subtly pointed out the disparity. This was music that spoke to him. Of course, Joni Mitchell herself was no longer the Joni Mitchell of those early albums. The last time he'd seen her, on VH1 at one of those charity concerts, she'd been droning on in a cigarette-ravaged voice, stopping in mid-song to lecture the crowd for not paying close enough attention to her lyrics. She'd seemed angry and bitter, a far cry from the open, giggly young woman captured on the live Miles of Isles, and it had been depressing and dispiriting to realize how much times and people changed. With the music on, his creative energy returned, and he quickly got back to work. He wrote for another hour or so, then stood and stretched. Maureen was gone, meeting with the manager of the only bank in town, trying to drum up some business locally and get to know some of Corbin's financial movers and shakers, and he was alone in the house. He walked upstairs to the kitchen and got out a can of Coke. He'd been cooped up in here almost all week, and he felt more than a little restless. The writing had been going well, but being indoors so much was stifling, and Barry walked downstairs and outside, grateful for the fresh air. He headed out to the end of the driveway and looked across the street at the forested lot next to the greenbelt. He glanced up and down the road, thought for a moment, then on an impulse went back inside, wrote a quick note to Maureen, and carefully shut the front door behind him. Walking down the hill, he turned on the first street to the right and slowed down, looking for the wooden post that marked the entrance to the East Bridal Trail. Even without the post, Barry would have seen the wide swath of open dirt that wound between the trees and away from the road, and he stepped happily from pavement to ground, feeling the delicious crunch of pine needles beneath his tennis shoes. It was one of the things he liked about Bonita Vista, the fact that it had green belts and bridal trails, though he hadn't availed himself of their use until now. He should come here every day, he thought, an hour or so to get some exercise and stop the spread of middle-age paunch that had materialized since he'd become a full-time writer. Maureen had been after him to walk with her, particularly after her run-in with that lunatic, but she wasn't a hiker, she only liked to stroll up and down streets, and he found it boring and pointless to simply traverse their neighborhood. After a few obligatory efforts, she'd given up on him and had started going out with Liz and one of Liz's other friends each morning, leaving him to veg on the couch and watch the Today Show.
but he liked hiking, liked walking on trails and being surrounded by trees and brush and the earthy smell of nature. Hell, maybe if he could convince Maureen to come with him, they could walk together. The trail curved down into what looked like a natural gully, following the contours of the land, winding between heavy copses of manzanita and a spread of wild holly bushes. The trees here were tall, much bigger than the ones on their lot or next to the road, and since no homes were visible from this vantage point, he had no trouble feeling as though he were in the middle of some dense, unexplored woodland. There was a sudden noise in the bushes off to his right, and though it was morning and a bright sunny day, a bolt of instinctive fear shot through him. He wasn't an outdoorsy guy, a nature guy, and unexpected sounds in unexpected places never failed to unnerve him. One of the hazards of his profession. As a horror writer, he always thought of the worst possible scenario, a mountain lion that would rip his lungs out, a bear that would tear him limb from limb. He wasn't the kind to ascribe benign causes or motivations to situations he encountered, and he stopped and looked around, listening, trying to determine where the noise had come from. There was the rattle of underbrush, and a sound. He froze, and it came again, a moan that almost sounded like a word. Whatever was causing it was definitely human, and the hackles rose on the back of his neck. He could not tell from which direction the sound originated, and it was not until he saw the movement of leaves and branches off to his right that he was able to determine how close the source was. From under the bushes crawled an armless, legless man, a dirty, tanned, and heavily bearded individual who pushed himself forward through spastic undulations of his disfigured form. The man's eyes were wild and unfocused, and the slurred, incomprehensible noises he made indicated to Barry that he was mentally retarded. He was wearing nothing but a muddy, blood-stained diaper, and when he opened his mouth, all of his teeth were missing. A chill passed through Barry, and though he knew that such a reaction was childish, that he should be feeling pity and concern rather than fear and horror, he could not help being spooked by the hideous figure before him. The man flopped into the center of the path, looked up at him, and shrieked. "It's okay," Barry said. "I'm not going to hurt you." He looked around to see if there was anyone else about, but the trail was deserted. "Do you need any help? Any—" The man shrieked again and began jerking convulsively on the ground, his limbless body moving up and down in obvious agitation. Barry had the feeling that the man was trying to communicate with him, was trying to say something, but whether the sharp cries and ragged movements meant that he wanted Barry to get the hell away from him, or that he needed some sort of assistance, was impossible to determine. The bearded face twisted upward on the corded neck, eyes bulging hugely, toothless mouth opening impossibly wide. Barry crouched down. "Do you want something?" The figure jerked, screamed at him. "I'm sorry, I don't—" He broke off, unsure of what to say, not knowing how to respond. The man cried out again, his flopping becoming ever more frantic. Barry backed away. Should he just continue on, pretend as though nothing had happened? He looked ahead. The trail before him seemed dark and forbidding, and he immediately turned around, hurrying back the way he'd come. He had no plan, no specific course of action, but he knew that he had to tell somebody, had to try and get the man some help. As bizarre as the incident was, as much as it creeped him out, he understood that underneath the horror show grotesquerie, this was a real person with obviously real problems, and that it was his responsibility to make sure that the authorities were alerted and made aware of it. He was jogging by the time he hit the road, and when he reached the intersection of his own street, he saw Frank driving by in his pickup. Barry held up his hands, waved him down, and the vehicle slowed to a stop. "Barry, you look like you've seen a ghost." "You're not far off." He was breathing heavily from the altitude and exertion. "I was hiking along the East Bridal Trail, and I ran into a man. A man without any arms or legs, who couldn't talk and was sort of slinking along the ground in a diaper." "Oh, that's just Stumpy," Frank said, chuckling. "He lives on the trails." Barry didn't know what he'd expected, but this certainly wasn't it. He'd been prepared to run back down the bridal trail with Frank to show him the limbless man, even to help carry the poor unfortunate back to the truck so they could take him into the doctor's office, the sheriff's office, or wherever assistance could be found. But he was not prepared for this cheerful recognition that there was a hideously deformed person living in the forest surrounding them, this open acknowledgement that there was a freak who spent his days skulking along the green belts of Bonita Vista, and that apparently everyone knew about it. It seemed surreal, like something out of one of his novels, not like something that could happen in real life. And for once, Barry was at a loss for words, uncertain of how to react or what to say. Frank must have misunderstood his silence. Stumpy's harmless, don't worry. I wasn't worried about him. I'm worried for him. He's... Barry took a deep breath. He's all muddy and bloody. I mean, shit, the guy doesn't have any arms or legs, and he's inching along on his belly in the middle of the woods. That's our Stumpy, Frank smiled sympathetically. Look, I know you want to help and all, but there's nothing to do. It's his choice. This is how he chooses to live. Who are we to deny him that and dictate what he's supposed to do with his life? He's an adult. It's a free country. Live and let live. I don't think he wants to be there, Barry said. He was howling like he was in pain, and I think he was trying to tell me something. Oh, that's just the way he is. Don't sweat it. Obviously, Frank did not understand his anxiety, could not comprehend why the sight of a filthy, limbless man crawling along the ground might give him cause for concern, so Barry dropped the subject. He nodded as the other man talked, pretended that everything had been cleared up for him, and said goodbye, watching the pickup continue down the road toward the gate. He walked back up the street, feeling at once disturbed by what he'd seen and learned, and at the same time oddly disassociated from it. The fear he'd felt was real, and a vestige of it remained with him, but his concern for Stumpy's well-being was more intellectual, less emotional, and did not hit him at the same gut level. The Suburban was not in the driveway, so he knew Maureen was still gone, and Barry continued up the street, past his house and directly to Ray's. Liz was outside, weeding, and she told him to go on in. Ray was on the deck. He let himself in through the unlocked front door, walked through the entryway and into the living room. He could see through the windows that Ray was on a chaise lounge, reading a book. Barry opened the sliding glass door, and Ray looked up at the sound. "Hey," he said. He held up the copy of The Coming that Barry had given him. "I'm reading your book. It's pretty damn good. I'm impressed." "Thank you," Barry said awkwardly. He never knew how to handle compliments about his writing, and while he wanted people to like his work, praise made him uncomfortable. Ray sat up, put the book face down on the small table next to him. "So what brings you up here to disturb my reading?" "Stumpy." The old man chuckled and stood. "So you heard about Stumpy, huh?" "Heard about him? I saw him. I was out walking on the East Bridal Trail, just taking a break from writing to stretch my legs a little, and all of a sudden I heard weird noises in the bushes. A minute later, this man with no arms or legs came squirming toward me, shrieking like a lunatic. Scared the hell out of me. I tried to talk to him, but he seemed retarded and he obviously couldn't speak. When I went back to get some help, I ran into Frank, who told me that it was just Stumpy, and that he lives out in the woods and apparently everyone knows about it." "Yeah," Ray confirmed. "Stumpy lives out there. I think he probably has a hutch or a lean-to or something, but for the most part he just crawls around wherever he wants to."
"And the people who live here don't care? They just put up with it?"
"Well, yeah."
"You don't think that's a tad bit peculiar?"
"Of course it is. But he doesn't live in Bonita Vista. He lives in the National Forest next to it. We've sort of agreed to let him roam the trails. I mean, who's going to prosecute someone like that for trespassing? Even the Homeowners Association isn't that hard-hearted. Stumpy's been around here longer than we have, and I think most of the people have a sort of live-and-let-live attitude toward him. We don't bother him, and he doesn't bother us."
"But isn't it sort of irresponsible to turn a blind eye to someone like that? I mean, he was wearing a bloody diaper, for Christ's sake. Shouldn't there be someone who at least makes sure that he's all right? That he, I don't know, has access to running water and a toilet? That he has at least the minimum necessities of life?"
Ray smiled sadly. "I'm ashamed to say I never really thought about it that way." He sighed. "Live here long enough, you get hardened to anything."
"So you think I should call someone? Social services or whatever kind of indigent help the county has?
Ray thought for a moment, then slowly shook his head.
I'm not a knee-jerk if it ain't broke, don't fix it guy. But in this case, maybe it would be best to let things be. Liz and I have been out here 9 years now, and in all that time, Stumpy hasn't needed any help, hasn't asked for any help.
He was screaming, though, crying out like he was trying to talk.
That's the way he does talk. He's always that way. I admit it's a little unnerving at first, but, well, like I said, you get used to it. I don't think he was upset or in pain or trying to enlist your help. More than likely, he wanted you to get off his trails and go somewhere else. He doesn't much like company, and he seems to be pretty possessive and territorial.
So there's nothing we can do?
There's nothing to do. Stumpy may be handicapped, but other than that, he's like any recluse or eccentric. If he had arms and legs and could talk, he'd still be living out in the woods, only you wouldn't think anything of it. You'd think he was some crazy survivalist and never give him another thought.
Well, that's exactly how you should think of Stumpy. What if sometime he really does need help?
Ray shrugged. I guess he'd make his way to someone's house and try to get their attention somehow.
Barry thought of that horrific shriek, of the way the limbless man had looked as he strained his thickly corded neck and opened his toothless mouth. A chill passed through him as he imagined waking up in the middle of the night to find such a sight waiting for him on his doorstep. Maybe it was just his line of work, the fact that he spent his days dreaming up horrors of the flesh and terrifying images of the supernatural, but he could not seem to summon the sort of understanding and acceptance that he knew he should have, and despite his well-intentioned sense of outrage, his real gut reaction to Stumpy was one of fear and disgust. Ray offered him a beer, but Barry said that he'd already been away from the word processor for too long and he'd have to take a rain check. He walked back down the hill toward home. The Suburban was back in the driveway, and Maureen was just clicking off the phone as he walked through the door.
Oh, she said, that was for you. Where have you been?
Out for a walk. Who was it?
Your old pal Neil Campbell from the Homeowners Association.
Jesus Christ.
Apparently someone complained that you were playing music too loud this morning. Neil wanted to inform you that Bonita Vista does have noise restrictions and the rules state that music cannot be played so loud that it can be heard from someone else's lot.
Too loud? It was Ladies of the Canyon, for Christ's sake. And you could barely hear it downstairs, let alone outside of the house.
I guess sound carries here.
Is he calling back, or does he want me to call him back?
She shook her head.
He'll send you a memo.
This is getting ridiculous.
Barry looked at her.
They're your friends. Couldn't you tell them that we like to listen to music, that it doesn't harm anyone, and by the way, mind your own damn business?
No one's trying to cramp your style, hon. They just want you to show a little more respect to your neighbors. It's not an unreasonable request.
It is if it infringes on my rights. I live here too, you know. And I should be able to live my life in my own house and do what I want on my own property without someone else trying to dictate and regulate my behavior.
They're only infringing on your rights at the point where your rights begin to infringe on other people's.
What kind of double talk crap is that?
It means that, yeah, you live here, but you're not alone. Other people live here too, and we have to take into account their feelings.
Shit.
He looked at her disgustedly, and they probably would have gotten into it then and there, but at that second the phone rang, and Maureen pressed the talk button as she brought it to her ear.
Hello?
The expression on her face brightened instantly.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah.
It's great.
Uh-huh.
No, not at all.
Yeah, hold on, he's right here.
She handed Barry the phone.
It's Jeremy.
He took the telephone from her hand.
Dude, Jeremy said.
Long time no hear.
Barry smiled as he heard his friend's voice, and for a brief second he was back in California, back in the real world, far away from Bonita Vista and deformed men and homeowners associations and pending memos about excessive noise.
Jeremy, you loser, it's about time.
Yeah. How goes it out there in the boonies?
He took a deep breath, and though he was still annoyed, still upset, he found himself chuckling at the absurdity of it all.
You're not going to believe it, bud. You're not going to believe it.
10. The Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions, Article 3, Land Use Classifications, Permitted Uses and Restrictions, Section 3, Paragraph M. Without limiting the generality of any of the foregoing provisions, no exterior speakers, horns, whistles, bells, or other offensive sound devices, except security devices used exclusively for security purposes, shall be located, used, or placed on any lot. In addition, any noise generated from the interior of a home, including but not limited to the sound from television, radio, audio reproduction, or live instrumentation, must conform to agreed-upon noise levels. No sound that is determined by general consensus to be a nuisance or that is audible from the lot of another resident will be permitted to emanate from any property during any time of day. 11.
I don't know, Ray. I just don't know. The two of them sat on canvas butterfly chairs next to the barbecue on the Dyson's deck, while the women remained inside talking. Past the town, past the hills, past the trees, the canyon lands were a brilliant orange. Sandstone cliffs dyed bright pop art colors by the setting sun. Barry looked over at his friend. You'd think that in a place like this, out in the middle of nowhere, they wouldn't have rules and regulations and homeowners associations. Tracts and subdivisions in Southern California, yeah, I'd expect it. But out here? He shook his head. Whatever happened to living out in the country with broken washing machines on the back porch and cars on blocks and angry dogs tied up in the yard? Ray stood and flipped over the burgers. Yuppiedom's gone national. It's everywhere, from sea to shining sea. You can't escape it. He pointed with his spatula toward Corbin. You want your white trash houses, your mean dogs and broken cars and junky appliances, buy a place in town. You want good views and big houses and cable TV, then you're stuck with Bonita Vista. He sat down again. That's the problem. All these city people like us, longing for a rural lifestyle, all us retired people and telecommuters, we want the comforts of home. We want fresh vegetables and gourmet food in the stores. We want fax machines and cellular phones. And we're willing to pay for it. But when we bring that shit out here, we bring the rest of it too. The gated communities and homeowners associations, the need for conformity and exclusivity. Turns out that we didn't really want to live the rural life at all. We wanted our city life with nicer scenery. You really think so? Tell me, Ray said, why did you buy a house in Bonita Vista? You liked the homes, right? You liked the landscaping and the views? If this hadn't been here, if the only homes for sale in this area had been the ones in Corbin, you would have moved on, found some other town to live in. You wouldn't have wanted one of those small, dirty houses with dusty yards or one of those broken-down trailers in the pines. The thing that attracted you to Bonita Vista is that it's clean and well-maintained. What you liked about this neighborhood is what the Homeowners Association has made of it. He paused. Me too. So we're hypocrites, huh? No, but we were lured here, trapped, misled. He motioned around him, at his house, at the other houses beyond. We thought this was all natural and organic. We didn't think it was an artificially maintained environment. Now we're living in this safe little bubble that's completely cut off from the rest of the town. I was talking to my friends back in California, and they were shocked when they found out we have so many restrictions here, so many do's and don'ts. You were too, weren't you? Barry nodded. Ray sighed. So was I, he said quietly. So was I. They ate inside, but after dinner all four of them retired to the deck. Liz lit citronella candles to keep away the bugs, and they sat on the wing chairs, staring out at the sky and the millions of stars visible on this new moon night. One star seemed to be moving, heading straight across the heavens at an even pace, and Ray pointed it out. That's a satellite, he said. I didn't know you could see those with the naked eye, Maureen admitted. You can out here. Back in New Jersey you couldn't. And probably not in California either. But out here, there's no light pollution, no air pollution. And if you stay out here long enough and your eyes get adjusted, you can see some pretty amazing things. They were silent for a moment, looking. I wonder why we never went back to the moon, Barry said.
Maureen groaned. Not this again. I'm serious. When I was little, we were supposed to have colonies up there by this time. What the hell happened? He was so brainwashed by all that NASA propaganda in the 60s, Maureen explained, that he feels cheated and personally insulted that he can't take a flight up to the Lunar Hilton on his vacation. Space travel's important, he insisted. Ray nodded. The future's arriving at a much slower pace than everyone thought. My father went from a world of horse-drawn carriages to a world of cars and planes and rockets and televisions. I think everyone thought that pace would be maintained, and it hasn't. Don't complain, Maureen said. We may not be things to come, but we're not escaped from New York either. Or Fahrenheit 451, or 1984, or Brave New World. Liz sipped her wine, smiled. Contrary to what Ray may think. Only because the Homeowners Association doesn't have the technology, he said. Not for a lack of willingness or inclination. Liz wrinkled her nose mischievously. See what I have to live with? Barry laughed and was about to chime in with a defensive ray, when, out of the corner of his eye, he saw colored lights and movement. For a brief crazy second, he thought it was a UFO, but he recognized almost immediately that the strobing red and blue lights were on the ground, coming from some sort of law enforcement vehicle. In the dark and through the trees, the lights seemed amplified, illuminating trunks and branches, the side of a house. What's going on? I don't know. Ray stood by the railing, squinting into the night. But whatever it is, there's at least two or three patrol cars down there. How come we didn't hear any sirens? Maureen asked. Beats me. Ray turned away from the railing. I'm going to check it out. He nodded to Barry. Want to come along? Sure. I guess the little women will stay home, Liz said loudly to Maureen. Since we can't accompany the men on their manly mission, maybe we can go back to the kitchen and make them a nice dessert for when they return. They'll probably be hungry. Ray looked at her, surprised. You want to come too? She smiled. No, but it would be polite to ask. Sorry. Barry looked quizzically over at Maureen, who shook her head. You boys go have your fun. We'll just stay here and gossip about you behind your backs. She turned toward Liz. Now, if you want to know what he's like in bed... The two women burst out laughing. Very funny, Barry said. Ray motioned him toward the door. Come on, I can tell when we're not wanted. Don't worry, Liz told him. We'll have all the world's problems figured out by the time you return. There must have been some residual heat from the barbecue on the porch, because when they walked up the driveway and out to the road, the temperature dropped. Goosebumps popped up on Barry's arms, and he suddenly wished that he'd brought a jacket. He and Ray walked down the hill, passing Barry's house and stopping for a moment to get their bearings, since the lights could not be seen from ground level. They ended up going down the street that led to the East Bridal Trail, and there, right before the post that marked the trail's entrance, stood a small crowd of people and two sheriff's cars, patrol lights on and flashing. Barry's first thought was that it was Stumpy, that the limbless man had crawled onto the road and been run over by a car or something. But there was no car in sight other than the sheriff's vehicles, and the tarp-covered body by the side of the road appeared to be full-sized. Wally Addison, the young deputy who'd taken their vandalism report, was standing next to a mean-looking older man who could only be Sheriff Hitman. Several neighbors had walked either up or down the street from their houses to see what all the commotion was about, and were milling around, talking in low, hushed voices. There was no police ribbon up, no authorities ordering people to stay back, but the onlookers seemed to be observing an invisible barrier, and they remained behind the cars, far away from the side of the road where the covered body lay in the dirt. Ray walked past that invisible line and directly up to the sheriff. "Saw your lights from up the hill," he said. "What happened?" Hitman nodded toward the tarp. Dead body. Annie Borum found him. Looks like he fell in the ditch and hit his head on a rock. Probably bled to death. Indeed, there did seem to be a lot of blood on the dirt and stones of the culvert, and Barry could only imagine what the man looked like under the tarp. Who is he? Ray asked. Anybody know? Deke Meldrum. We arrested him up here recently for harassing a young woman. The deputy said something to Hitman in a low, inaudible voice, and the sheriff raised his eyebrows, looking over at Barry.
I guess that was your wife.
Barry nodded, his stomach tense. The second he'd heard the name, he recognized it, and he was glad that Maureen had decided not to come with them. He tried to speak, but no sound came out, and he cleared his throat.
I thought Meldrum was locked up.
Oh, he made bail day before yesterday. Court date's set for next month when the circuit judge comes through, but until then he's out on his own recognizance. Hitman paused. Or was. The sheriff turned away, obviously not intending to answer any more questions, and Ray went over to talk to some of the gathered residents. Barry followed. Around them, the pine trees seemed taller than they did in the daytime, the black bulk of their closely grown forms blocking out all but a thin strip of stars. The flashing red and blue lights created a sort of shield about them, boxing them in against the darkness of night, and the faces of the crowd, bathed in the strobing colors, were unreadable. The scene was surreal, made even more so by the realization that Stumpy was probably hiding out there in the woods, watching this, taking it all in. Barry scanned the lower bushes and the beginning of the bridal trail, looking for a telltale glint of eyeshine, and though he saw nothing, he shivered. Ray was asking Russ Gifford, a young man Barry had met at the Dysons' party, what he thought had happened.
You got me. I just saw the lights and came out to investigate. I thought it was probably an accident or something, maybe a burglary. I didn't expect anything like this.
He nodded toward the bearded man on his left.
Hank says he heard the guy was creeping around, casing the neighborhood, and he tripped and cracked his head open.
Is that true? Ray asked.
The bearded man shrugged. I don't think anyone was actually there to see it, but that's what I heard Annie told the law, and she was the one that found the body.
Annie Borum, a fitness freak of the First Order, had apparently been on one of her nightly jogs when her flashlight had illuminated Meldrum's feet poking out of the ditch. She'd run home and dialed 911.
She never came back out here, though, Hank said. I guess she was pretty freaked out about it. Didn't want to see it again. They probably interviewed her at her house.
A middle-aged woman standing next to a young man who could have been her husband, could have been her son, said that she heard Meldrum had been hit in the head with a rock, and that that had knocked him into the ditch, where he hit his head on another rock and died. The retiree next to her said that it was kids, that teenagers from town had been hiding in the brush, throwing rocks at passing cars, and they'd accidentally hit Meldrum, taking off and running back to the highway so they wouldn't get caught. Rumors were rampant. No one in the crowd seemed to really know anything. Most of them had simply been drawn by the lights the way they themselves had, and after waiting for the ambulance and watching it take away Meldrum's dead body, lights and siren off, Barry and Ray started back up the hill the way they'd come. They had company until they reached Barry's street, but then their silent companions headed in the opposite direction, and the two of them continued on alone. Neither of them spoke for a moment.
"Did you see all the blood?" Ray said quietly.
Barry nodded.
Yeah. Looked like an awful lot for someone just tripping and falling on a rock.
You think those guys were right? You think he was hit before he fell? Ray didn't respond.
What?
Barry said. Ray shook his head.
Come on. You don't want to hear what I think. I don't even want to hear what I think. I'm just a paranoid old buzzard who should be on the internet all day spreading conspiracy theories.
Tell me.
Forget it.
Come on.
You really want to know?
Of course. Ray stopped walking and turned toward him.
I think the Homeowners Association bailed him out. I think they did so because they knew he'd return here and they could get a little vigilante group going and run him out of the county, maybe out of the state. But I think something went wrong. I think they meant to just scare him, but somehow things got out of hand and they ended up accidentally killing him.
Barry laughed. He couldn't help it.
That's wild, he said.
Ray shrugged and started walking again.
Told you.
The laughter faded, and despite the outrageousness of the claim, Barry found that he was unable to dismiss it entirely. While he didn't exactly believe it, he could believe it. Such a scenario was within the realm of possibility. That in itself was frightening. They walked in silence for a moment. Is there any way to check, to find out for sure who bailed him out?
I don't know, Ray said. But I'm going to call the sheriff's office tomorrow.
What if it's true? What if the association did bail him out, and now his dead body's found up here in Bonita Vista? You think the sheriff will look into that? You think he'll see a connection?
Ray shook his head. I told you before, he's in their pocket. I don't know whether he's getting actual kickbacks or whether this is just the usual law enforcement kowtowing to moneyed interests. But he's beholden to them, and there's no way he's going to upset the apple cart by investigating them.
You think Meldrum has family in town?
I don't know.
They trudged up the hill. If that is what happened, Barry said, if the association did bail him out because they knew he'd return here, and then they killed him, and no one investigates it, and the case is closed, that means that they'll get away with murder.
Ray didn't answer. They walked the rest of the route without speaking. Maureen and Liz were no longer on the deck. The bugs had apparently grown immune to the scent of citronella, and the two women had come inside to avoid being eaten alive. They seemed to be in a good mood, but when Barry and Ray gave them a rundown of what they'd seen, it put an end to any hope of finishing the evening on a high note, and Barry and Maureen went home soon after. In bed, getting ready to fall asleep, he told her Ray's theory that Meldrum had been bailed out of jail by the Homeowners Association specifically because they knew he would return here, and that they'd gathered together a vigilante group to scare him, but things had gotten out of hand and he'd ended up dead.
That's ridiculous, she scoffed.